that the space, if we have a tensor product of a bunch of vector spaces, and we take its dual, well, that's linear maps of this into the scalars, then that's could be identified with V1 star tensor, V2 star tensor, so on. See, because this is an element of the, this would be a tensor that has the form A, B, blah, 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 C, and this would be we want to map that. An element of this space would be a tensor of this form. So we want something if we want something in the dual space, we want something that maps that into a scalar. And the thing that'll do that, of course, is a tensor of the form like that. When you contract one of, I shouldn't call it by the same name. Call it some other name, sort of SA, which you can then contract with TAB to get a scalar. Okay. So that, all I'm saying is that a tensor with completely covariant indices can be contracted with one with completely contravariant indices, and that'll give you a scalar. And conversely, any linear way of taking such a tensor into a scalar can be given by another tensor. Well, you'll be able to prove that if you want when we introduce bases, that it'd be one way. One remark here is that such a map, when I say it's a linear map, it's a linear map on the tensor. So it takes, in other words, if we take the sum of two tensors like T1 and T2 and contract them with the same tensor, we'll just get the sum of the two resulting scalars. However, if we think of T originally as what it is, which is a sum of products of vectors from V1, V2, and so on, then regarded as a map on those vectors, it's a what's called a multilinear map. So we could say the map multilinear, it's called multilinear, on the factors that make up the given tensor that we started with. Okay, so that's another way that you get a tensor. You have a multilinear map on a bunch of vectors, and then you regard that as a linear map on the tensor product of the vectors. Okay. So let me illustrate this with a couple of just one simple case. So an example is would be a tensor with this index structure. Of course, last time we defined these abstract indices. So this means what this means is that it belongs to the tensor product of these two spaces. Sometimes one says it's a tensor of type 1, 1, meaning it has one contravariant index and one covariant index. I remind you also that for us, V, in this development, V can really be any vector space, but it'll almost always be the tangent space to the space-time at some point. So let's take this particular tensor. So suppose TAB is equal to just, not suppose it is. It always is equal to a sum of products of vectors and covectors. We can write that in, now we have two ways to write that, the sort of abstract index way and the sort of quantum information way or the other way using the tensor product symbol explicitly. So I'll just call these, I shouldn't call this V, I'll call it omega k. And so now if we use the abstract index, we just say, so this is trying to say it's a tensor product of a vector and a covector. So if I use the abstract indices, I write it like this, or I can write it in the other way, which is the sum So this would be k equals 1 to some number, whatever it may be. This would be the same sum over k. I would not use the abstract indices to show what kind of tensor it is. You just have to know. And then and again, these k's are just labels, so it just means v1, v2, v3, omega 1, omega 2, omega 3. Okay, so given such a tensor, now we can regard it. So how can we regard it? What can we use it to map into what? So one very simple thing, one obvious one, I claim that it maps, we can regard it as a linear map from V into itself, right? How do we do that? Well, we can take an element V, a vector V, in the vector space capital V. Obviously, we can map it to, and we're always doing it by contraction with this tensor. So there's only one thing we can contract it with. And we do it like that. And that gives us, of course, a second element of the vector space V. So a mixed tensor like this is a linear operator in the vector space V. Yeah, question?
Is one of the indices supposed to be downstairs from the second expression?
Which is the second expression?
T-A-B, all up.
Oh, it should be, thanks. Right, yeah, this should be. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, because the indices have to match. Here it's downstairs, and here it's downstairs. By the same token, by contracting the other way, we can view this as a linear map of V star into itself, right? So we would just take omega goes to say omega b, which is supposed to be downstairs, tba, for example. Remember, the actual names we give to the indices have no meaning in themselves. So I can use A and B the other way for convenience. So omega A would be mapped to that combination. So that also gives us a map of V star into itself. And then similarly, we can also treat T as a map of V star tensor V into the reals. How? Well, again, by contraction, I think it's obvious. You take now a tensor and you contract both indices. It has to be a mixed tensor itself, and it could actually be, if we make the distinction, which is a kind of almost trivial distinction, but depending on which the order we write the indices in the abstract index case, or the order in which we take the factors, we could regard it as mapping V star tensor V or V tensor V star into itself. There's not really much distinction between V star tensor V and V tensor V star. So we saw when we discussed symmetry, there's a natural way of identifying tensors in this with tensors in this. So now the most important, any more questions on this? So the most important special case now of this, or at least a very important special case, is this Kronecker delta tensor, or the identity tensor, so this is a mixed tensor. We define it now by its action on the vectors. So this is turning it around. Given a tensor of this index structure, it gives a linear map of V into V, and every linear map of V into V is a tensor with this index structure. So I want to introduce a tensor which is really trivial. It's just the identity map of V into V. So take the identity map into V into and regard that as a tensor, and we call it the Kronecker delta. So of course what that means is that its definition is this. That's the linear map that does nothing, really. Equivalently, as I claim that it's equivalent. Remember, we said that this tensor T could be regarded as a map also of V star into V star, dual covectors into covectors. So what does it do to them? So it would be, I think, surprised if it did anything, since it's not doing anything to the vectors. And that's, of course, true. It's equivalent to say that Kronecker delta AB acting on some covector, which I'll call omega A, WA in this case, will give you WB. So it's the identity, both one acting on vectors and one acting on covectors. Why is it equivalent? Well, this is the kind of thing you might just play with proving this kind of thing, because it gives you a feeling for all the definitions. In this case, let's actually do the proof. So let's take this equation here and contract it with some sort of an arbitrary covector A. Okay, just to contract. So this was the definition that tells us what the Kronecker delta tensor is. So that's the equation that defines it. Let's contract that equation with omega, an arbitrary omega WA, and I called it here. And so then we get WA delta AB VB is equal to WA VA. Now, here it's important. I mean, these are all trivial steps, but they're worth going through carefully at least once. And this brings up the important point that this is a dummy index, right? This A is a dummy, and so we can use any other letter for convenience, and so it also equals W. The reason that we want to change it is I'd like to get the index on the V's to be the same in both cases, so I can factor it out. So it's WBVB. Now, having written it in that way, I can factor it out, and I get WA delta AB minus WB acting on, contracted with VB equals zero. So we started with any old tensor covector W, and remember, in this equation, V was also arbitrary. So since V is arbitrary in this equation, if you have a covector which, when contracted with an arbitrary vector, is zero, well, by definition, that means that that covector is zero. So that implies the other equation, WA delta AB equals WB. Okay? Yeah.
If delta AB is a tensor, then we should be able to write it as a tensor product.
You could write it as a sum, as a sum of products of vectors. You can, and that's exactly what we'll do when we come to bases. So just looking ahead, there'll be a completeness relation, which will say that we can write this and with these are concrete indices, and they'll be so there's always. For concrete indices, we'll always use the summation convention. And so I don't really need to write this sum. And so it'll be, that's exactly what you'll be able to do. So we'll come back to that. There'll be a basis consisting of vectors and a dual basis to that consisting of covectors, and we'll be able to write it exactly in this way as a sum of products of these vectors. Is there another question? One thing that I just want to mention without going into it, there are also things which we haven't talked about at all, but they become rather important when you deal with integration and like conservation laws, and when you deal also with fluids, for example, things that have currents associated with them or sources for the electromagnetic field. So those are called tensor densities, in particular vector densities and scalar densities. This root minus g, which we have seen only in expressed in terms of a coordinate chart, this square root of minus g is actually what's called a tensor density. If you wanted to ask what kind of thing is it, so this is a scalar density. So in a more complete treatment, we could also define this. And then the other thing is called, has different names, but one of the names that I like best is an axial tensor. When you, if you've seen the definitions, so this is also sometimes called pseudo-tensor. It's like the difference between the electromagnetic field and the electric field. One of them is a vector or a polar vector. The electric field usually taken to be the polar vector. And then the magnetic field is an axial vector, you know. In other words, you need something like a right-hand rule to define it. It's not a real, it's not quite a real vector in the same sense that the electric field is. So these are things which under reflection acquire an extra minus sign, and these are things that under dilations acquire an extra factor, an extra power of the dilation factor. And there is actually a geometrical way of thinking of them. I'll just say it, but I won't develop it any further. What they actually, they can be thought of as outer products. So it's the same tensor product idea, but of ordinary tensors of the sort we've defined with two new kinds of things, depending. It's either with a sort of a volume, it's a kind of object that represents a volume, a region, a small extended region of space-time, or just a portion of space-time. That's what I mean by a volume. I don't know a better name for it. Extension, well, let's just call it a volume. Or in the case of the axial tensors, it's represented as the outer product of a ordinary tensor with an orientation. And it's, in fact, if it has a factor of this orientation, an orientation is something that changes sign under a reflection, and a volume is something that gets bigger or smaller. A portion of space-time gets bigger or smaller when you expand or contract things. So I just mentioned that there's actually, they do fit naturally into this framework, but for the sake of brevity, I'm not going to go and define them as well. But they do appear implicitly a lot, mainly in the form of this particular scalar density, square root of minus g. But also when it comes, as I said, when you come to conservation laws, when you want to say that I'll just mention this. So I can call it JA, the electric current density. That's a vector density. The reason we can get away with not defining these explicitly is because we always have in the case of relativity, we always, not in other settings, but in the case of space-time physics, we always have the metric tensor available, which we can use to convert between these objects. Orientations is another story. There's no simple thing that we have available. So that leads to more that tends to lead to more confusion than the densities. But we always have. In fact, if you really wanted to, since we always have the metric tensor available, we could always work only with contravariant tensors because you could always raise all the indices. But that turns out not to be a very convenient thing to do, and it obscures some of the basic relationships. Yeah.
Sorry, you said this, that a density is a tensor product with a volume?
a volume, or actually a power of some volume, yeah, an object that represents a volume, and it can be raised to some power. So I should say a number of volumes, including you can, in some sense, allow a fractional number of them in that case. So volumes are their inverse, so maybe I should say power of a volume in general. So this one is, in fact, it's got one inverse power of a volume in it, the scalar density. You see, the reason it has, since this came up, anyway, the reason that this really has one inverse power of a volume is that when you write an expression like square root of minus g d4x, this is the kind of thing that I mean by a volume. It represents a small portion, an infinitesimal portion of the space-time, and we multiply it by this object and we get an actual number, which is, we call the volume element, which is the volume in the quantitative terms of that little portion of the space-time. So there's like, here's d4x, right? And then dv is the measure of that volume, which we get by putting it. So you want something which, when you multiply it by this d4x, gives you a true scalar. So you want something that's got an inverse power of a volume. That's actually how it works. So tensor what are called densities of weight 1 have one inverse power of the volume. Densities of weight minus 2 have two powers of the volume, and so on. So next. Talk about bases and components. Okay, so here is where you'll start seeing formulas with concrete indices. Tensors will start looking into, looking like arrays of numbers and so on, which is, as I keep saying, one of the definitions, in some sense, the more old-fashioned kind of definition of a tensor and a vector and so on. So just for sake of representing this, of writing these formulas, I'll assume that the dimension, which I'll call n, is equal to 4 of our vector space. And then, of course, since it's a 4, and as always, this vector space will tend to be the tangent space to the manifold. So since it's 4-dimensional, that means by definition that there is a basis. And I'll call the elements E, which I'm not sure why it's a traditional, but it might come from a word for unity, anyway, meaning in German. Anyway, I'll call them, using the abstract index notation, I'll call them E, A, sub, or whatever, over alpha. So the for a while now, I'm going to try and keep to the rule that if it's a concrete index, I'll put it in parentheses, just, and I'll try and keep it as Greek. And if it's an abstract index, I'll try to keep it as Roman. And I won't put it in parentheses. So this is an abstract, so it equals 1, or in this case, 0, 1, 2, and 3. I have to write that, wasn't it? 0, 1, 2, 3. I don't actually need to write it twice. So there, it's just 4. So in other words, this is just a set of 4. This is just a shorthand for saying it's E0A, E1A, and so on. It's a set of 4 vectors. If I have to refer to it, the set as a whole, I'll just call it B, the basis. So what we know by definition of the basis is that, now let's take an arbitrary vector VA, which is in our vector space V. We know that it can be expanded in the form as a linear combination of basis vectors, which means that there are some coefficients, which I used here, some numbers V0, V1, V2, and V3, which when I multiply them with the basis vectors and add it up, I'll get back my original vector V, right? So this is This is using the summation convention, which is exactly, it's the sort of component mirror image of the contraction convention we made before. That if two indices, had they been abstract, they would have been contracted. Now we regard it as just, when they're concrete, we make them assume all their values and sum over all values, right? So that's the familiar summation convention. And then we call these V alpha, we call those, these are by definition, the components of the vector VA. Okay. So just to take another example, consider a tensor like T, A, B, C, all contravariant. We know that it can be written as a sum of products, say U, V, W, A, B, C, plus F, G, H, let's say, A, B, C, plus maybe other terms like this. I don't have to write the tensor product sign because I have the abstract indices to show that I'm dealing with a tensor product. But we know, so what about it? Well, we know we can expand each of these vectors. In this case, I didn't introduce any covectors. We know that we can expand each of these vectors in terms of the basis, so let's do it. So UA becomes UL using exactly just this formula. This is just a cute, this notation is like a well-oiled machinery. It just allows you to do what you always can do, but it makes everything, you can do it without thinking twice. So if you just follow your nose you follow the notation, it leads you by the nose. It makes you write the right thing. So in this case, we would write U alpha E alpha A, and then the same way U beta E beta V, and U gamma, this should be V, and this should be W gamma E gamma, I don't know what this prime came from, E gamma C plus blah, 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 blah. And then if we expand all that out, we can see what's happened. We just get U alpha V beta W gamma plus, in each of these terms, we just have the same factors, E alpha A, E beta B, E gamma C. So then we'll get F alpha G beta and so on. The whole thing will then multiply E A alpha E B beta and E C gamma. I got the indices right. Right. So this is giving us a set of scalars, which I'll define to be T alpha, beta, and gamma, this is a large number, it's now I guess 64 numbers, so it goes from T 0, 0, 0 all the way up to T 3, 3, 3. These numbers, which when I multiply them by the tensor product of the basis elements, gives me back the tensor. And so it's natural to call these the components of the tensor TAB with respect to the basis B. Okay, so if I use a different basis, I'll get a different set of components, obviously, just like I do for vectors. But once I've chosen my basis, then I get a well-defined set of components for the tensor. And what this is, what this is implicitly doing also, and what it's exhibiting here really, is the rule for formation of the components of a tensor product from the components of the individual tensors, or in this case, vectors, that goes into the product. So since this is a key thing, just to underline it, let me write it again in the case where I don't use the abstract index notation, which it tends a little bit to clutter up the story. So suppose I use the other notation. It shouldn't make any difference to the result. And I won't bother with the other terms. Then if I expand this out, it's equal to, now I've just did the exact same expansion, but I'm not using the abstract indices. So because I'm using instead, what do I want? V, this is going to be a V. Okay. And that, of course, is equal to U, just as we had before, U alpha V beta W gamma, plus maybe other terms, all multiplying E alpha tensor. It's exactly the same equation you see above, just in the other notation. Again. So again, it's what it's telling us is two things. First, it's telling us, so it's a special case. Suppose T just was U tensor V tensor W, no other terms in the sum, then T alpha beta gamma would equal U alpha V beta W gamma. So in that special case, you see that the components of the tensor, which is a product of vectors, is the product of the components of the vectors. Okay. And again, in these formulas, alpha, beta, and gamma are concrete indices, and they each go independently from 0 to 3. So if you represent a matrix, like you might represent a vector, you know, by a row, sort of like a column vector, say, of components, and you represent a two-index tensor by a matrix, then this three-index tensor becomes impossible to really draw on the blackboard, but, it's represented by a cube, and so it's natural to arrange its indices in a cube. So what this is telling us is that if E1 or E0, E1, E2, and E3 is a basis for the vector space V, then the set of products E alpha tensor E beta, let's not worry about the third component, that gives a basis. I'll just do two of them now for V tensor V. So, of course, again, what it means is E0 tensor E0, E0 tensor E1, and so on, all the way up to E3 tensor E3. Oh, I'm not putting, in some cases I put it, parentheses, and some I didn't. I don't really need them because once I write numbers, then they're automatically concrete indices. It's very unusual to use numbers, although I've done it sometimes. It's very unusual to use numbers as abstract indices. So what it's telling you is that you can make a basis for a tensor product by taking the tensor product of the basis elements. And that has the consequence . So this is a key thing, and that implies that the dimension of a tensor product, let's just call them any arbitrary two vector spaces now, or even I'll call them V and W, the dimension of that tensor product space is just the product of the dimensions . Why? Because this has this, whatever the dimension here, that's the number of basis elements this has. Whatever the dimension elements here, that's the number of basis elements that W has. So if you take all products of the basis elements from V and W, you get the product of those two numbers. The number of elements in a square array is just, in a rectangular array is just the product of the height and the width. Okay, so that's a key also. Any questions on that? Yeah.
Aren't the abstract indices unnecessarily confusing?
I think they are at this very abstract, oddly enough. At an abstract level, they can be confusing. But there's, I think last time I mentioned that there's two things that they do for you. They make contraction, the notation of contraction goes much more smoothly if you use them. And if you don't think about how you would represent contraction with the other, with the non-abstract indices. And then the other thing that they do is they show symmetry properties naturally. And but probably the best reason for using them is they allow you to write equations in a way that reminds you that they're not, that those equations, tensor equations, like the Einstein equations will be. They allows you to write those tensor equations in a way that reminds you that they're not just equations about components. And they, when you're trying to derive something from something else, they sort of, keeping that in mind, it guides you which kind of steps you should take. But if you just have a bunch of numbers, you could do anything with them. You know, you can multiply the third component of this with the fifth component of that and subtract the second component of that. That's a number. But it, when you think from a tensor point of view, that doesn't make much sense. Right? You would be adding together something that belong, that were components of things in different tensor spaces and so on. So, I mean, I would never claim that you couldn't live without the abstract indices. But I think experience shows that they are useful. They are helpful. And as I said before, if you don't like them, you can in the end forget about them because you could just read every equation that uses the abstract indices as if it was an equation in terms of concrete indices. So whenever you have a valid equation for abstract indices, you can always just, as we'll see in a second, you can always replace it with the corresponding equation in concrete indices. So now we want, so we're almost finished with bases, at least, well, not really. Anyway, but the other basis we need is a basis for, since we're dealing with tensors that are products of both vectors and covectors, tangent vectors and covector, whatever that's called, tangent covectors, we also will need, if we want to talk about components, we will need dual basis. We'll need a basis for the dual space V star. So given a basis B, which we had, which was, I think, somewhere over here, which was a basis for the vector space V, it gives us a basis, which I'll just call V star, for the dual space V star. And I'll call that basis I'll call it a set. One thing is that it should be clear after you play with this a bit, or if you've been looking on the board, is that going from a vector to a covector is sort of raising and lowering everything. So a natural notation, I mean, putting everything wherever, the opposite of where it was. So a natural notation for the dual vector basis is like this. And so this is alpha equals 0, 3. So this is a basis for V star. And what is this dual basis? Well, it's defined, it comes from the basis. It's tied to the basis V. So these two correspond to each other. I mean, we could introduce completely independent bases for V and V star, but it's convenient to tie them together in this way so that when we apply one dual basis vector to a basis vector, we get a matrix, the identity matrix. We either get one or zero. In other words, we define it by, so this is the definition of B star, we define it by E alpha A, which is the one we're trying to define, E A beta, which is the basis we already have, that should equal delta alpha beta. So that's the definition. Obviously, we could have gone the other way. We could have started with a basis vector, a basis for V star, and used this equation to define the basis for V. This defines this dual vector, this covector E A alpha, because we've said how it acts on every basis vector. And once we know how it acts on every basis vector, then we know how it acts on every vector, because we can expand any vector in terms of the basis vectors, right? Yeah.
Sorry if this sounds nitpicky, but didn't we define the tensor delta AB in terms of concrete indices?
Good point. So this is, yeah.
No,
so
abstract indices.
Yes, I know what you meant, yeah. I actually heard abstract, but. So this is the matrix. So that's a good point. So we could say, I haven't yet defined what is the components of a tensor of a covector. Well, I sort of just did because I told you what the basis is. Now that we've defined the basis, we know how to take the components of a covector. Therefore, we know how to take the components of a mixed tensor. So this notation, so this is this when I said it was a smoothly oiled notation, that's kind of machinery. This is an example of that. So now we have an ambiguity that you've just noticed in how we read this. So what I meant by this was where I've defined this as just the matrix zero, you know. In other words, I've defined it as equal to one, the usual, if alpha equals beta and zero otherwise. If alpha is not, that's what I mean by this expression. But now you may come, now your nitpicking is quite justified. You could come in and say, yeah, but I could read this as another way. We defined the tensor dAB. What if I read this as the components of that tensor? And the nice thing is that you'll get the same result. So we don't have to be careful about it. Which you can easily check for yourself. So what is it'll become trivial when we see how the rule for, which we've almost seen, when we see the rule for contraction, then you can check explicitly that this, but that's a good point. So these, when I wrote it, I just meant this definition, but the notation would be very clumsy if these were not also the components of the Kronecker delta tensor. Fortunately, they are. Now, from this follows what's called the completeness relation, which is EA alpha E alpha B. I guess this, to answer Sam, this is also a situation where using the abstract indices sort of makes things flow smoothly. When you want to expand, we'll see, when we try to expand the tensor, for example, in terms of bases, this notation works rather nicely, and it wouldn't work so well, I think. You know, I have to think about it, but I think it doesn't work as nicely. Well, for example, these two relations. So what is this completeness relation? This is relating to your question. This is another equation that you could write down. What this is, now, this equation is saying that when we contract a basis, we take the inner product of some covector coming from its basis with some vector coming from its basis, we get ones or zeros. When they match up, we get one, and otherwise we get zero. This is a different equation. This is a tensor equation. Right? It's saying that if we sum this from zero to one, we get the Kronecker delta. And I won't prove it. again, the proof is on the same lines as, I mean, all those proofs are sort of on the same lines. Just apply this to an arbitrary vector until you get back the same vector. And so this is sometimes called the completeness relation. And what does it do? It allows you to just, again, in a mechanical way, expand out anything in terms of its components. So, for example, something I wanted to... Oh, yeah. So this answers a question that someone raised earlier. Can I write the... Oh, you raised it. Can I write the Kronecker delta tensor as a sum of products of vectors and covectors? So if we expand out... If we were to expand this out, what it says is dAB is equal to EE00 AB plus EE11 AB plus blah, blah, blah. Two more terms, right? And these are, of course, tensor products. In the other language, it would be E0 tensor E0 plus E1 tensor E1 plus blah, blah, blah. So in fact, we can do this with any tensor whatsoever now. So let's just see, for example, the vector B. We already, of course, by definition, know how to expand out a vector in terms of its components. But let's just see how the completeness relation gives us the answer. We just insert one. We just write V as one, the identity operator acting on V, the Kronecker delta contracted with V. Then we plug in what the Kronecker delta is. It's E alpha A B V B, and we get E, well, I don't, now we just parenthesize it a certain way. There's no need really to rewrite it. And now by comparison, let's compare that with what we know. Oh, well, I don't even have to write another equation. What is this? So I just plugged in this completeness relation. What is this? This is a scalar because it's a contraction of a vector with a covector. And then this is, that scalar multiplies this basis vector and we add up. That's another way of saying this is how we defined the component alpha of the vector V, right? It's that thing which when we multiply it by the basis vectors and add them up gives us back the vector. So what this tells us is how to, for another way to form the components of a tensor, in this case, components of a vector. So before, you see, we said that you can get the components of a tensor by just expanding out that tensor in terms of basis, products of basis vectors and covectors. That's true. But another way you can get them is just by contracting in all possible way with the corresponding dual vectors. So, and this is the simplest example, so I'll just put et cetera, meaning it works for all, this rule works for all tensors. So if you want the components of a vector, you just contract it with the basis covectors. If you want the components of a covector, you contract it with the basis vectors, and so on.
But no. You can expand VB as the product of the components with the basis vectors, and then you can use that Kronecker delta relation on the top of the board
to get it. Yes, yeah, so there's something wrong with this way of getting it. I don't think you're saying there are many ways of proceeding.
Yeah.
But in any case, so that's what I meant by calling it a well-oiled machinery. So if you write anything that makes sense, it's going to be right, basically. That's the nice thing. Not all notations are so forgiving. So this is another way of getting the components. Actually, you're familiar with this. This is you know, in quantum mechanics, you're probably familiar with taking the component. If you have a vector psi, you often write it like this. All that's saying is that you get the nth component of the vector, the Hilbert space vector in this case, psi, by contracting it with the dual basis. So this n is a basis for the Hilbert space, and this n is actually, turned around, is actually a basis for the dual space of the Hilbert space. In that case, there's more data there. There's a metric there that allows you to convert between this and this. So there's another complication, another part to the story. But anyway, this is an example of that kind of notation. And when we write in that language, when we write 1 is the sum over n, say, I don't know why I called it n, because I used n. Anyway, I just mean n, an arbitrary label here. When you write something like that, that is this relation that I've written here. Right? That's the same relation in a different notation. And so more generally, so more generally, I can do the same thing for, as I said, for any tensor. For example, just to take an example, this tensor, this mixed tensor, TAB, I can write it as, when I want to expand it out, I convert these into, I'll use this one. Well, not, will I? No, I won't. EA, E beta, B, where, so here I've expanded out in terms of its components, where the components are given by this rule here, which is T alpha, I mean, they can be produced by this rule. If you have access to these dual bases and basis vectors, so that's just an example of applying the same rule to the tensor. So you see how the notation guides you, because you want a contravariant index here, a covariant index here. It has to be, you have to get this, well, let's say here, you have to get this by contracting with basis elements. Which ones? Well, just the, you know, the fact that this is contravariant means I have to contract it with a covariant, in other words, a covector. And then I put the index, the label for this covector basis element up on top. And then notice it's also a contravariant vector. So all the conventions for where you would write the indices match up nicely. Same here. I'm summing over this and this. And so this alpha here is upstairs. This alpha there is underneath, the way I've written it, underneath the basis vector. More questions? So what about contraction? So what we're doing is, yeah, we've shown how to get components, how to expand out tensors in terms of basis vectors using the components, how to obtain the components by contraction with basis vectors and covectors. What about contraction of the indices of a tensor? So basically we did a bunch of things like symmetrization and so on, sums of tensors and tensor products. Now that we have the components, we want to see how those things appear in terms of components. So what about contraction in terms of components? So suppose we had a tensor TAB and we contract, there's only one contraction that we can do here, so, which is TAA. How do I write it in terms of components? Well, the rule, I mean, you could expand out everything. But the slick way is to use this trick of the completeness relation that always gives you the components quite directly. So we introduce a factor of one, so to speak. So I can do this, right, obviously, because for two reasons, if I contract this with, if I can contract first on the B indices, then I'll produce, it'll just change this into an A. Or if I contract first on the A indices, it'll change this upstairs index into a B, right? So this equation is true anyway. And then this, but then I expand out, then I use the completeness relation. So the trick or the procedure, the sort of algorithm is introduce Kronecker deltas and then expand out using the completeness relation. So this is delta AB, so it'll have a sort of EA, EB, and then I have to introduce the corresponding. Now read this another way. So this is one, this is the Kronecker delta, expanded out using the completeness relation. But now, when we look back at the definition of components, this is a covector contracted with that index, and this is a vector contracted with index from the dual basis. So this gives us the components of gamma. This gives us the gammath component and the gammath component of the tensor T. So what does it mean? It means that contraction is just summation according to the summation convention. So contraction is just summation in the usual form of the, it's what you might call you might call it a sort of partial trace. In this case, it's not partial. It's because there's no indices left free. However, if we have just like one other example, let's take a tensor equation of the form that looks like this. What this is telling us is that the covector R is made by a contraction of this tensor TABC on its second and third indices. How does that look in terms of components? Now it will be actually be a kind of partial trace. It tells us, that says is that RA is TABC, the same trick. So I've sort of pulled the contraction apart and replaced it with a delta. And then I can expand this out, T, A, B, C, E, B, E, C, and what do I call this, beta. This doesn't really have a name, but you might call it T, I might represented in terms of a kind of mixed thing that has one abstract index and has some abstract and some concrete indices, and it's summed over the concrete indices. I put in parentheses because it's not entirely a standard notation, but you see what it means. It's a partial trace. It's very analogous to what you do exactly in partial trace when you have product systems in quantum mechanics. So if we want to turn it into an equation that's of a more familiar type, what we're really asking was what's the relation of the components when R is a contraction of T? What are the relationship between the components of R and the components of T? So we want, in the end, the component of R. So that's R alpha. We have to get that by contracting the dual basis vector with the basis vector with R, it's a covector. And so that, if we look at what we had over here, it's T, A, B, C, E beta B, E beta C. I'm just taking this down here and contracting it with E, A, alpha, right? But now, of course, by the this again is the standard object, that standard way of getting the components of the tensor, and now it's all the components, so it's just T alpha beta B, right? So again, it just does what you want without thinking, basically. And what it tells you in this case is that the components of this contraction are precisely given by this partial trace operation. You just, if we contracted the second and third indices, we just set those indices equal and sum over all their values, and we keep the first one, whatever it might be, the so-called free. So again, this is the free, and this is the dummy index. So let's summarize the rules. So what are the rules for addition, outer product, and contraction? Addition is just addition of components. I put here a word pointwise, by which I just mean add the corresponding component. So this is the most obvious one. The tensor is a big rectangular array of numbers. If its components are, then a big cube, what's the word, cubical or array of numbers, then you just add, you just take the two cubes and you add corresponding numbers. So that's the most trivial. This is tensor product or outer product, as it's also called. That's multiply the components. But I don't know how to say this in a nice way, but in all ways, in all combinations. So here we've added corresponding components. Here we let the two indices vary independently, and we multiply together all the components in all possible ways. And I think you know what I mean from before. This includes, by the way, as a special case, scalar multiplication, if you think of a scalar as a tensor of zero indices, a rank zero tensor. And then finally, contraction. We just saw the rule for, I also don't know a nice way of putting this in words, but we sum the matched components. As I said, it's a kind of partial trace operation. Okay. So at the algebraic level, I mean, as far as general tensors, that's all that I want to say about components. Now we'll go to coordinate bases. I mean, the special case that comes from using a coordinate basis. So are there any questions on this? Okay. So we want now to apply this in the case where our bases come from a coordinate system. So I'll just remind you of some things that we already know. So let's look at this picture. Here's our manifold. Here's a chart. So that we call, I think, U sub C. This is the manifold M. These are the kind of pictures we had a few weeks ago. There's a point P, and over here we have our vector space that defines the chart, which, since it's a coordinate basis, that means that the chart is R4. And this map C that takes you from the manifold to the to R4, which means that it attaches to every point of the manifold four numbers, which we usually call x0, x1, x2, and x3. So this is a vector space V, but it comes sort of with a natural basis. So R4 has a natural basis, which is just the four vectors 0, 1, 0, 0, and so on, 0, 0, 0, 1. And in fact, if you think about what that means, it means that if you take the components of a vector, it just gives back the vector itself. In the case of R4, the vector is its set of components. And Rn it also has a natural basis, which sometimes people write as to distinguish what kind of space it belongs to. Sometimes they write, you tend to write vectors as column vectors and covectors as row vectors, though it's not necessary always. Okay. And again, if you take the components of that, since R star n is naturally identified, it should be 4 here, really, is naturally identified with R4 itself. In other words, in both cases, it's just a set of numbers. If we make that identification, then again, the components of the vector are the vector itself. I mentioned that because there's a kind of confusion. When you map a tangent vector here, you might think you get a tangent vector here, but you actually get a vector here. There's actually no distinction in some sense between a tangent vector and a vector here. But anyway, if you remember the map C star that we defined, it takes tangent vectors here to vectors here, which are elements of this vector space, which are just sets of four numbers. But if you were worried that why didn't I get a tangent vector here, the answer is that there's no distinction between a tangent vector here, really, and a vector here. So now we have, this is really review of what we had set up before. We have a vector, but there'll be some new features now to be brought out. So remember what we did. We had a tangent vector here. We mapped it here, and that gives four numbers, and we called those the components of the tangent vector. So what it means is that we use this map C star, which mapped T P of M into R4, we use that to transfer the basis that R4 has back to the tangent space T P M. And that means the components of UA in TPM are just R. I'm using the abstract index notation, are just C star of UA, which is an element of R4. So these are the components we introduced earlier, and that's how we introduced them. A formula that I could write that I'm not sure I did write before that may also help clarify what's going on. So imagine here we're in this manifold again, P, and then we have a nearby point, a sort of infinitesimally nearby point, which is, I could think of as P plus DP, or Q, which I sometimes call Q. The components of, so this is a vector, that's intuitively what a vector is. So I can write using the abstract index notation. I can write it like this to show that it's a vector. Its components, it has components dp alpha, and they're just given by dx alpha. So that's yet another way of expressing the relationship between the components of the tangent vector and the coordinate system. So if the x alphas, there are these, so a vector in this I've called x0, x1, and so on, x3. So those are just the names for the components of this vector, this R4 vector. Then if you want to know the components of an infinitesimal displacement in the manifold, you just ask how much did the corresponding coordinate change when you go from one point in the manifold to the neighboring point. So that's that. That's another way of expressing the rule that we had before. And we can also draw a picture for this, if I can get this. So here is so here's the here's the manifold, and here, what I've actually done here is I've used the map. What I'm about to do is I've used the map C to attach the four coordinate labels to every point of the manifold. I'm regarding the coordinates as functions on the manifold, as we saw before that you can do. And so consider some point P, let this be the point P, and let these be the lines of constant. I'll just do the two-dimensional case. Let these be the lines of constant x2. In other words, let's say this is x2 equals 0, x2 equals 1, and so on. So the x1 axis, so to speak, goes in this direction. This will be the line of x1 equals 0. This will be the line of x1 equals 1. Well, here I'm using the coordinates 1 and 2, okay, just for illustration. If I got this right. Oh, no. All I did was shift. This is supposed to be x1 equals 0. And this is x1 equals 1. This would have just been an inconsistency. Okay. So this is x1 equals 0, x1 equals 1. So as we move in this direction, x1 varies. As we move in this direction, x2 varies. Then the basis vector, I mean, you really have to think of these infinitesimal, if you like. But the basis vector, what I called EA1, is just the vector pointing along the one direction here. And the basis, maybe I can... And the basis vector EA2 is this other one pointing along that. So that's a picture that you could have in mind. So it's just the standard flat space picture, but everything is kind of distorted. But you think of this as an infinitesimal neighborhood, and I really wanted to put P here, not up here. So I want these to be basis vectors at P. So these are basis vectors for the tangent space at P, using as usual the fact that in an infinitesimal neighborhood of P, everything is flat. So we have the tangent space. The other way of writing this is the sort of more precise way that doesn't use infinitesimals. So the way that avoids infinitesimals is to say that EA1, remember how we define tangent vectors, now I put this A to show that we're dealing with a vector. We define tangent vectors as equivalence classes of curves, and this is the general notion of a tangent vector. It's just the formal derivative of a curve in the manifold. So, but which curve do we have to use in order to get the first basis vector? Well, we have to use the curve that runs along the first direction there. So another way of saying that, or what that says, is that when we transfer this curve to R4, it's just going along the first coordinate axis. So it's lambda 0, 0, 0, et cetera. Okay? All this, as we saw, is as we saw before. However, what we didn't do before is the dual basis. So so how do we get the dual basis? Oh, what's the connection? I mean, what this shows us, what I just did, shows us the connection between the coordinate system and the basis vectors. What about the dual basis vectors? How are they connected to the coordinate system? Okay. So in order to do that, I have to first define, the answer will be that the dual basis vectors are the gradients of the coordinates, the corresponding coordinates. But in order to make sense of that, I have to define the gradient operator, which I'll write like that, which allows us to take a scalar field and give a covector, which we call the gradient of the field F. And it's defined by the following. Now we're going to use something that we had before, which was that, remember, any linear map from tensors to another tensors is given by itself a tensor. In this case, a gradient operator is supposed to be just a covector, so it'll just be a map from vectors to scalars, which is, in fact, just the definition of a covector the way we did it. So it's defined in the following way. I'll write the infinitesimal relation first. That's always somehow conceptually clearer. It's that when we take the gradient of F, okay, which is, going to be a covector, so I use this index like this. When we contract it with an arbitrary infinitesimal displacement, what is it going to give us? Well, if you think about what it means, the gradient of F along a vector sort of you think of the definition of gradient, you'll see that this is the natural definition, and it's sort of the only natural thing I could have written down. We just want that covector, which when we apply to a given vector, gives you the change in the function f along that vector. So it would be, in this case, in that picture I drew, this what I'm calling df here. Where did the picture? Oh, here's the picture. So if f was a function defined on this a real function defined on the manifold, then what I say by df here, I really mean f of q minus f of p, right? So the point is that the change of f, if it's a smooth function, the change of f along in any direction is just given by a linear rule. And that linear rule is called the gradient. If we want to write it in the other language, it doesn't involve infinitesimals. It just means dividing everything. Introduce a parameterized curve as before. Divide everything by d lambda that we had before. And then we just see that that's d by d lambda of f of gamma of lambda, if you like that. Now, I claim, I also want to draw a picture here. So I claim that this dpa, this map that takes dpa to df is linear in dp. Okay. If it's linear in dp, then it defines a covector. So I claim that it's linear. If that's true, then it follows that this map, which I've called DAF, gradient A of F, at a particular point P, belongs to the tangent, cotangent space, the dual space to the tangent space at P of the manifold M, which I could write like this. It's the dual space. It's usually just written like this. Okay. This thing is called the cotangent bundle in technical language. So how do we show that it's linear? Shall I show it or shall I just assume it? It's all tracing the notation through. I might just skip it because. What do you think? Let me prove at least what I wanted to get to, and then, if necessary, I'll go back and prove the claim that I just made. Okay. So what I want to establish now is the rule that I said. So I want to say that if we given a covector that arises as the gradient of some scalar function f, I take its alpha component. What I want to show is that that's just equal to partial f partial x alpha, which is just the formula that you're familiar with. But at least it's the formula that you're familiar with. Yeah, it's the formula you're for sure familiar with in flat space. Again, it's kind of just a notation. So let me establish it. So in proving it, let me just take the case where alpha equals 2, just to make it as concrete as possible. In that case, remember the rule, which I might have just covered up or erased. Remember the rule to get the alpha's component. Okay, so let's go. So we had some covector. Maybe I should actually give it a name. We had some covector omega A, which is just the gradient of F, defined according to this rule. So remember the second component in this case, will just be gotten by contracting the second basis vector. So I need to contract the second basis vector with this covector. What is that? What is the second basis vector? That's d gamma of lambda d lambda A times this, I have to choose the appropriate gamma lambda, the appropriate curve to give the second basis vector. So it's this one in that picture, runs along the 2 direction. So that means that when I transfer it to the chart, I just get something that runs along the second coordinate axis. This looks like the third, but remember, it goes 0, 1, 2, 3. So it's the second coordinate axis. So I've taken that curve and brought it back to the manifold. Um, But this is equal to, by the, if you think of the way we actually defined the gradient over here, it's equal to d by d lambda. It's just the rate of change of that function f along that curve. So it's, it's just d by d lambda of f of gamma of lambda, which is d by d lambda. Oh, now I have a problem because I introduced a notation that I skipped over, f tilde. So I'll call this so I've defined f tilde. F tilde is a function on R4, so it's just the function f transferred to R4. So it's, what is that? It's f circle C inverse. In other words, if I want to attach a number, I want to get the scalar field on R4, that means to attach a number to every point of R4. So I first transfer that point back to the manifold, and then I apply the function f. So in other words, it's just the scalar function f in those coordinates. That's all it is. And so then that by but the rate of change of this along is df tilde dx. This is exactly the definition of the partial derivative taken at the origin, where I put the C of P as the origin, in, as normally we do in the chart. Okay, so this is now an equation in the chart. So it's just the usual Cartesian coordinates, and this is just the gradient of f tilde, which is just the directional derivative along of f tilde in the second direction. And this is equal to, but that's equal to what you mean by the gradient. If you think it through, it's just the partial derivative of f with respect to x2. That's what we mean, right? To hold f fixed. Anyway, to hold x1, 2, and 0, and 3 fixed and go along the 2 direction and ask how rapidly does... So as I say, it's how rapidly does f change? So as I say, it's just sort of unpacking the notation. So it's this is either true by definition or it's true as a trivial theorem, depending on exactly how you define this partial derivative. I just remind you, so f was a scalar. So all we're saying is that this component of the gradient of the gradient covector that we defined, the alpha's component is just the rate of change of f as you move along the alpha's direction in the coordinate system. Okay, so it's nothing remarkable. It's just in effect a check that all the definitions hang together in the way you would want. Now the other thing, however, there was one thing left open, which was to prove, so how rapidly can I do this? I think not quite rapidly enough. So if people want to see it next time, I'll start with that. Otherwise, oh, there's one other thing that I want to prove, which we'll start with that, which we'll either start with or do simple next. The other thing that follows from this, you can check for yourself, is that is an expression for the basis covector, which I mentioned before, that it's the gradient. So x alpha is the coordinate function is given by x alpha is, well, in some sense it is C. How do I say that? It's given by, C of P is equal, for an arbitrary P, is equal to the 4 x0 of p, x1 of p, and so on. In other words, x alpha is, capital X alpha, is just the alpha's coordinate regarded as a scalar field on the manifold. Okay, that's what we'll start with. I mean, I'll prove that next time. And then we'll be almost done. We'll introduce metric tensor and orthonormal basis. Okay. Any questions?